Hey, y'all. Welcome back to the Shifting Schools podcast. My name is Tricia Friedman. And on this week, we are speaking with Dan White, the CEO of the educational game developer Filament Games. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about Dan in just a moment. But the headline for this episode is really thinking about the power of play, the power and joy of games, and games as, again, a way to help students really amplify and discover curiosity in newfound ways. This is also a great episode for those of you who have students who are passionate about the world of games and are thinking about what potential career pathway they might find. Before I tell you a little bit more about Dan, I also want to let you know that this episode is a little bit of a sneak preview for our summer mini-series, which is going to be all about the power of play. So if you have specific inquiry lines about the power of play that you want us to dig into, now's the time to reach out to Jeff and I to let us know what you want from that summer mini-series. You can always contact us at info@shiftingschools.com. That email address is over there in the show notes. Before I tell you more about this week's special guest, we've got a quick word from our show sponsor.
Are you in the middle of your teaching career and wondering how to best manage your finances? Money Pickles Financial Advisors specialize in helping educators like us. They offer practical advice on investments, savings, and even navigating pension plans. With Money Pickle, you're not just getting an advisor, you're gaining a financial partner who understands your unique needs as an educator. Head to moneypickle.com/shiftingschools today to sign up for a complimentary, no-obligation video call with a financial advisor. That's moneypickle.com/shiftingschools. We thank them for being a sponsor of this podcast and of educators at large.
Dan has overseen the development of over 200 games, apps, and AR/VR experiences for clients like Scholastic, McGraw-Hill Education, National Geographic, and more. He's an authoritative thought leader across game-based learning, edtech, and AR/VR for learning. Dan has presented at huge, high-profile events like South by Southwest, EDU, Games for Change Festival, and more. You can find his work on sites like EdSurge and Everything VR and AR Podcast. Welcome to the show, Dan White. Dan, it's great to be speaking with you. You're sort of prolific in the space of learning games. We're going to talk about your career and the work that you do. You've worked to see more than 200 games be developed in your career. I'm going to repeat that number so that folks, you know, don't think they might have misheard. That's 200. You know, we would say that positions you to be in a really unique position to be thinking about what's coming for the future of learning games. Can you talk a little bit about any predictions that you have or perhaps aspirations? Where would you like to see the world of learning games go?
That's a great question. So my predictions and my aspirations are usually the same because I am a positive-oriented person. And so it's very hard for me to, particularly for my passion, learning games, to envision a future that doesn't involve a particular pedagogy around game-based learning that I have been pursuing since the dawn of my time in this industry, starting in grad school. And that is one that I hope to be advanced by current events, which we can get into a little bit momentarily here. But basically, I'll start with my master's thesis, because that was a pretty darn good instantiation of what I believe good learning games look like and where, of course, based on what I just said, where I think the field is going as well. And that is toward game-based experiences that are focused more, less on kind of didactic facts and figures and knowledge transfer, and more on skills and conceptual understandings and the ability to translate the educational experience into the ability to do something of import outside of the game and indeed outside of any educational context in the real world. So what does that actually mean in practice? Well, practice there is kind of the key word. Like, how do we impart a useful practice, mastery over a useful practice to a player? And a lot of times that's either things that directly look like real professional practices, whether it's engineering or medical practice, or the constituents of those practices, which is to say the skills and abilities, the mindsets, the perspectives, the identities, and the ways of thinking that underpin success in those professions. And for a long time, I thought of this approach. So I shouldn't leave people hanging. So my master's thesis, just to button that up, was a game about ocean science. And we positioned the player in the role of an ocean scientist. We gave them the tools of ocean science. And we said, here are some really interesting scientific questions to answer about an ecosystem. And we modeled an ecosystem. We said, take these tools, go into this ecosystem, and collect evidence, and then make a scientific argument based on the evidence that you collect. So there's no right or wrong per se. It's really about, again, the student learning how a scientist thinks, learning how a scientist uses tools in order, the tools at their disposal, I should say, in order to answer those open-ended questions to the best of their ability. Now, fast forward, what has it been, 18, almost 20 years, almost two decades. And the game that we're working on that I'm personally very involved in right now is called RoboCo, which is a robotics game where we're sort of taking that original vision from two decades ago and instantiating it in the world of robotics instead of ocean science, where you are tasked with solving a problem through the lens of robotics with the tools of robotics at your disposal. But how you solve it is really up to you. And we've seen for each individual challenge level, there have been, you know, dozens and dozens of incredibly clever, thought-provoking solutions. So that's the game-based learning future that I believe in and am advocating for and I do firmly believe will come to pass. And that's one in which the problem spaces that we put forth in games look a lot like the problem spaces that real humans are encountering on a day-to-day basis in meaningful professional practices. And I want to emphasize the word humans there, because the reason why I'm more bullish on this vision of the future of game-based learning than ever is because of the rise of automation, machine learning, and most recently, artificial intelligence coming on to the scene in a very visible way for everybody, regardless of what discipline you work in, whether that's in or out of formal education or in informal education or what have you. There was a moment, I wouldn't want to say 4 or 5 years ago, after I finished reading a book by Kai-Fu Lee called AI Superpowers, where I was pretty convinced that the workforce was in the process of undergoing some pretty significant changes based on AI and automation, but that the time horizon for those technologies having a significant impact on what the workforce would look like was much closer than perhaps I had realized before that. And I think closer than most people would have realized at that time. Now that's very salient, I think, for most people, given the rise to prominence and the zeitgeist around artificial intelligence right now. It feels much more palpable, much more real, much more immediate. So it definitely calls to question this idea of what is worth teaching and what is worth learning and what is going to prepare students for the future outside of school, which is obviously not the only reason that school exists, but it's one of them, right? I think we can all agree it's at least one of them. And now that these technologies are having such a significant impact on what the landscape of work will look like outside of school for people who are in K-12 right now, we have to be sort of revisiting this question of what's worth teaching, what's worth learning. And I think the answer to that question is one that will direct us toward the type of game-based learning that I just described, which is these more open-ended problem spaces where humans have to use uniquely human skills, I think a lot of overlap with what we previously referred to as 21st century skills, higher order thinking skills, future facing skills, the systems thinking, the problem solving, the collaboration, et cetera. Whereas I think there was perhaps less urgency for those types of games to exist as little as 5 years ago.
There's so much that I want to ask you about in that response. And I actually kind of want to rewind a little bit. You mentioned Kai-Fu Lee, whose work I really appreciate too. And, that is a thinker who has also sort of talked about the value of what some would refer to as like science fictional thinking. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what you were just doing in thinking about like, what are the possible futures? What do I need to do in order to get there? And I just finished reading a great book from futurist Amy Webb called The Signals Are Talking. And Webb, talks a lot about how we can be looking for patterns, making predictions based on those. And something that she says all the time is you also really need to pay attention to the outliers, the people who are saying things that seem like, that's really weird, or that could never happen, that you actually like, you want to pay attention to some of those voices, because sometimes actually they are the ones who are noticing where things are headed right. in a way that others don't. And I'm wondering, as the CEO of Filament Games, what you were talking about was both kind of understanding what is enjoyable learning, like, not just what are the necessary skills, but how can we make learning actually a little more human? Yeah. Like we're using human-centered skills, and also our approaches are really respectful of one another's humanity. So I'm wondering, you're talking about understanding that piece, understanding game design, thinking about the future, but also running a business. And I'm wondering for you, what are some of the skills that have been really important for you in your growth with Filament Games? Because we love having this conversation on the show. We know that we've got people who are listening. Both they'll be intrigued by like what is there for me to tap into in terms of learning games. Mm-hmm. But we also know that our educator audience love talking to their students about, hey, you're passionate about this thing.
Yeah.
There's a potential career pathway there. Yeah. So can you talk a little bit about the skills that have been really fundamental in getting you to the position that you're at? And again, in that realm of you've got to be doing so many things simultaneously.
That's right. Yes. Multitasking is definitely one of them. Although I feel like that is a necessary evil as opposed to something that I would ever advocate for teaching, just because I do believe that deep thinking and deep work is really valuable to the extent that we're able to protect our time for that sort of endeavor. I think this answer is going to echo my previous one in many ways, because a lot of what has been valuable to me from a skill perspective in growing a business and building those 200 plus learning games across the last almost two decades is just that problem solving, right? Like every day as a leader in an organization, and I think even at this point, really at all levels of an organization, what we're ultimately doing when we get up and go to work is we're solving interesting, hopefully interesting problems, but we're at least solving problems. And those problem spaces vary dramatically in shape and size, but for a small business, and particularly for a small tech company, every day feels like an exercise in being handed a series of unsolvable problems and coming up with the best possible solution within the constraints or parameters that are in front of me. And I remember reading this, as I say this out loud, this is starting to sound like self-flattering. It's not meant to be, but as I read Barack Obama's book about his time in the Oval Office, it really resonated with me, because I was like, oh yeah, your days are just one intractable problem after another, like problems that have no good solutions. And yet you do still have to come up with a solution. And then half the, people will hate you for that solution, and the other half will perhaps celebrate it, maybe best case. And that's kind of what it feels like in the world of small business as well. Every day is a collection of of problems that just don't have any obvious right answer. And so I think that's why, from a game design perspective, I love problem spaces that don't have any obvious right answer. And part of that, I think, is a response to the culture of K-12, at least what I was exposed to as a student, which is this sort of enculturating young people to the idea that there is a right answer, which I think is just the you know, like outside of flat content is just not how the world works, right? In any sort of reasonably complex system, which if we're doing meaningful work, we're probably doing it inside of some kind of reasonably complex system. Otherwise, somebody else would have already done it. So, you know, part of that is by virtue of the fact that we're working in a little bit of a frontier space here, being in the industry of games and learning, trying to build games that have never existed before, about things that nobody's ever built games before, using game mechanics that have never been used before. But even just from the purely, like, even if we were a company, you know, a company that, you know, cleaned office buildings or made isotopes, or, you know, small businesses, in my experience, when talking to other small business leaders, we all kind of, regardless of what industry we're in, are faced with this same types of and shape of challenges that I just mentioned. And so if anything, I would love for there to be more opportunities for young people in formal K-12 contexts and outside of formal learning environments to be grappling with the idea that the world is messy and that there are usually very few instances where there's a clear right or wrong answer.
Yeah, I appreciate that answer because I think you're right. Like, you know, the nuance, the gray, the idea that things are complex and very rarely simple is also the life of a young student too. You know, there's no one right way to be a friend. Right. I feel like that is their so-called real world all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, but following up on what you were saying in your passion for problem solving and leaning into that chaos, you've also developed and cultivated some quite impressive partnerships, McGraw-Hill, National Geographic, to name a few. And I'm wondering, you know, it's not as though building partnerships like those, I'm sure you didn't just, you know, oh, there's National Geographic is on the phone for me, answer it. Hey, you want to partner? Sure, done.
Yep, exactly.
Or if it did, that would be incredible. Congratulations. But we love talking about, you know, the need to more explicitly teach collaboration, you know, that really, regardless of what field you want to go into, unless you want to be running a lighthouse, right, you are, you know, very often going to have to collaborate. And I should have somebody that runs a lighthouse come on the show, because I bet they even need to do some things that are collaborative as well.
Right.
Can you speak a little bit more about what it has meant for you to, you know, you've mentioned being a small business, but you're a small business with mighty big partnerships. So how does that come about for somebody who's listening and they're thinking, I'm teaching the next CEO of, you know, a company like Filament Games? How can I help them be thinking today about those collaborative skill sets that they need to cultivate? And why are those partnerships so important in the work that you do?
Oh, yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah, I think what I've found over the years for Filament is that we come into a space that's much older than us, that is full of large incumbents, like you mentioned. And we come at it with a particular lens about how to innovate in the space and to drive positive change. And, but at the same time, innovation is disruptive. Innovation is uncomfortable. Innovation often involves the use of tools that people that are unfamiliar to people. And I think it's very important, because of that, to leverage both the trust factor, the reach, and if we want to just get really practical about it, the brand loyalty, the knowledge, the depth of knowledge and experience that comes from some of these larger incumbent organizations who have been working in education for years and years and years. And by the way, as far as I can tell, all these large organizations, whether it's organizations like Smithsonian or Nat Geo or textbook publishers like McGraw and HMH, they all kind of trade P people over the years. So regardless of which one you're talking about, most of these people working for these organizations have incredible depth of experience, which I just have a tremendous, in education, which I have a tremendous respect for as a sort of tech-oriented entrepreneur who comes at the world of education through this lens of a new way of experience-based, game-based pedagogy. So I think it's really, just from a practical perspective, it's really important to pair any kind of new technological approach, any innovative technological approach, with partners who have a breadth of perspective and can say, well, that's a great idea, but that's entirely impractical. So you can, you know, it'll be a fantastic game, but nobody will ever use it because it requires a super high-end PC, and they don't have super high-end PCs in the classroom. Or that's a great idea, but that's a long-form 10-hour experience before you, you know, in order to cover three learning objectives, and teachers don't have that kind of time. And that's just not how the classroom is structured. You've got maybe 30 to 40 minutes to do an experience at a time. So a lot of it in the beginning was learning from people at those organizations about how to practically compromise around some of our objectives in introducing a new pedagogy into schools. That's part of it. And then you'd also, I think the other part of the question was about how to even develop these types of relationships in the first place when you are an upstart. And for us 20 years ago, just a massive amount of networking, going to conferences, shaking hands, meeting new people, giving talks, sort of, yeah, trying to be visible, espousing our values, evangelizing, just hustling, right? And, and I do think that that is a big component of collaboration that is often perhaps overlooked as a skill in a traditional K-12 setting, right? Because in many cases, we want people, like classroom management is obviously a huge challenge. We are not really engendering a culture of like a whole bunch of people talking all the time because we're trying to communicate knowledge to them. So there's not a lot of really great spaces inside of traditional K-12 environments to work on those types of skills where we actually want people to be aggressively social and almost like socially disruptive in a way, because it's a weird thing to walk up to a stranger and strike up a conversation at a conference and try to do business development. But that's a lot of what building those networks initially involves, which is in some ways counterculture to the idea of being a recipient of information and sort of staying organized and quiet while that learning happens. So it is definitely a skill. It's a skill that I think anybody can learn. It's obviously a little bit easier if you're sort of a naturally gregarious person. I tend to be somebody personally who is orients toward being social, but I'm also exhausted by it as well. So it occurred to me about 4 years into running Filament that I should hire a business development person because there are actually people who get energized by that type of collaboration and communication. But it is definitely a skill that anybody can learn.
Well, I think it's a good reminder, though, because schools can create some of those opportunities for students to lean into that mm-hmm. rehearsal. You know, there's, I would say, kind of a growing popularity around the concept of what some refer to as mix it up at lunch day, mm-hmm. where, you know, it doesn't mean every single lunch you're sitting with somebody different, but it's maybe a once a month opportunity for you to be going through that idea of, you know, yes, like there's a lot to learn from a lot of different people, yeah. and it can be hugely beneficial to break out of your own social bubble. So I think that's a great reminder about schools. What are you doing to give students those opportunities? You know, again, it's an important life skill to be able to introduce yourself, to be able to get to know folks who are new that are not necessarily, you know, have the same exact interests. that you do.
I love that because I'm a huge believer in the value of social capital. I mean, as I think about the value of my company right now, a lot of it is the relationships that we have built over the years and the social capital inherent in that. And I think this is, I mean, there may be some people listening who are thinking, oh, well, sure, that's a great skill if you're a salesperson, biz dev, or if you're a business leader or an entrepreneur. But I think that that skill is important for everybody in every part of any organization, because it's not just about trying to get things from people when you're networking and collaborating, communicating like that. Like, there is just a tremendous amount of opportunity for serendipity when you are making connections with other people, regardless of whether or not they're in your field, regardless of whether or not they're the same age as you, regardless of, you know, just getting a diversity of ideas from a diversity of people. In my experience, as I'm networking, whether it's at a social engagement or a party or at a formal conference or what have you, I almost always learn something new from other people. There's always a, oh my gosh, we have this thing in common, and I never would have expected that. There's almost always a, oh wow, now we have, each of us has some new opportunity based on a connection between us that feels like complete happenstance or serendipity. So yeah, networking is an exercise in sort of rolling the proverbial dice, and oftentimes, at least in my experience, I found that there are just incredibly fruitful outcomes that are entirely unanticipated as I get to know new people and talk to strangers.
You're reminding me, we did over a year ago an episode with Dori Clark, who's very well known in the world of business, is almost always in Harvard Business Review. And she said the exact same thing, that she credits all of her success and folks that she's coached to their capacity to build a network. Yeah. And she kind of also touches on something else that you mentioned, and that's really clearly knowing your own values or the values of your business. And I want to touch on one that Filament says, and this is right there. I grabbed this from your website. Filament Games says that they, quote, create playful experiences that improve people's lives, end quote. Dan, that's a really big, bold statement. And I'm wondering if you can walk us through, in practice, what does that mean? Why can play be so powerful? Is there sort of an anecdote that really brings that to light? Because I think, you know, we've talked a lot about so-called traditional K-12. And, you know, if you're at a school that really has not changed very much in the past 20 to 30 years, that's probably an environment in which play has been devalued. Mm-hmm. So for somebody who, you know, unfortunately has kind of forgotten the power of play, talk to us a little bit about, again, why that's part of your values, but what it actually looks like in practice.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I'm a firm believer that, you know, play was the original classroom, right? It's how animals of all different species learn when they're new to the world. They, you know, play is about experimentation. Play is about, it's safe simulation, right, of different ideas and practices. And it's powerful because it is safe, because you can take risks, because you can try different things and see what happens. It's powerful because it's an opportunity to try on different identities. It's powerful because it's an opportunity to actually do something hands-on. And I use that, I don't mean that literally, but oftentimes it is literal. But it's an opportunity to have that educational experience be driven by very personal, very relevant, very situated experience, as opposed to anything that feels abstract or distant. So yeah, play is just a wonderful, wonderful tool for learning and just human development in general, from my perspective. And I think the sad thing is that it is often associated with triviality, or, you know, being a waste of time, or just being sort of fun oriented. And then, of course, it is fun if you're doing it right. But I think part of the reason that it also gets a bad rap is, like, it's time consuming, right? Like, play is not, almost by definition, cannot be too directed, which means that it's a somewhat circuitous route to learning. But that is like, good things take time, right? I'm a big believer in that. And I think that play as pedagogy is besides being powerful and underutilized, is also just a really terrific way to get people interested in things that they otherwise they may not have had a pre-existing affinity toward. And that may not sound like a big deal, but when you really think about it, a lot of, in my mind, a lot of the purpose of education is less about teaching somebody something, and it's more about getting them interested in something that they may not have previously been interested in, right? Because if somebody's interested in something, they will teach themselves for the most part. People, I'm a firm believer that people are kind of like wind up toys. And if you wind them up correctly, then they'll march off toward the learning objectives on their own, of their own volition, without too much scaffolding. People do this all the time, both in and out of school. You know, you look at any affinity space and you're like, well, why? Wow, people have gone so deep and so hard into this affinity. What is it that motivates them? Well, usually it's intrinsic. So the question becomes, if it's not intrinsic, how do we get people to develop new affinities so that they do march off toward those learning objectives on their own? How do we wind them up? And that's where I think play is a huge tool, right? Because a lot of times one of the barriers to developing a new affinity is that if it's not innate, or if it's not based on some past experience that you had, then there are all these, one of the barriers to that are, well, it takes actually like a fair amount of cognitive effort to sort of climb this initial, what I'll sort of describe as initial barriers to familiarity with a particular subject area or domain in order to understand why it's interesting, right? And what play does and what games can do that model play as pedagogy is they can make that initial, typically high friction period much smoother. They can make that on-ramp kind of silky smooth and in fact enjoyable, whereas traditionally it might be cognitively very high effort. And then if we can get people over that initial hump of like understanding enough about a domain to understand why it is interesting and why it might captivate their interest, then it's kind of all downhill from there, to extend the analogy. So that's why I'm so, apart from the reasons that I mentioned initially, the biggest reason that I'm excited about games in particular as a form of play is that I really think that we can get people over that initial hump of affinity towards something that they're not naturally predisposed to be interested in.
Yeah, you know, it's fascinating. The more research I do into the benefits of play, there's so much research out there about just our overall health, our mental and our physical health, how important it is. And I'm a dog parent, if you will. And there's actually research that shows that dogs are the only species that until they die, they will, you know, opt in for play. Like sometimes as we age, you know, we almost need a little bit of nudging or begging, you know, to be playful. But dogs sort of have this predisposition to be playful their entire lives. And, you know, I love dogs. And I notice, again, like, you know, they're kind of known for being happy all the time. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how much of that just, you know, that joyful disposition that a lot of dogs can instantly tap into.
Yeah.
Is that connected to it? I can't help but think it isn't. You know, again, filament games, though, it's not just about some of those benefits. It's also about impact. You kind of talk about that directly. And I'd love for you to tell our listeners about a partnership that you've had where you feel like this is a wonderful example of the impact that a game can create as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. One of the partnerships that I like to point to when asked this question is ICEVIX, just because it's been our longest standing partnership across the last 18 years. We've been working with ICEVIX since, I want to say, 2008 or so. This is an organization that is teaching civics through a game-based curriculum. We've developed over 20 games with just them at this point. And the games are used in all 50 states. Their most recent annual report showed that 9 million students have played iCivics games, and for a total of 150 million, what they describe as meaningful plays, which is, you know, it's got to be long enough that it was a play session where they presumably either completed the game or got through a fair number of the learning objectives in the game. And I can't think of a more profound impact of, or example of impact from any kind of game-based learning intervention, just in terms of the sheer statistics compared to iCivics, which I think speaks in part to the need. I think there was a real need for for better tools for teaching civics for teachers. So there was a hunger there. And then also just the games are really well designed for the classroom context. I feel like they're the sort of right level of depth, right level of length. They're web-based, they're free. So they just kind of like eliminate all the friction points that sometimes get in the way of educators being able to adopt games in the classroom. Now, are they, you know, that vision that I was talking about at the beginning of the podcast of these open-ended problem spaces? And no, but that's, I definitely don't want listeners to walk away with the idea that there are not other really, really positive and impactful examples of game-based learning methodology and pedagogy apart from dialing it all the way up toward open-ended problem spaces, because it's definitely not the case. I'm a firm believer in the idea that depending, you know, your game mechanics and your approach to game design really needs to reflect needs to vary depending on the context and depending on the specific learning objectives. And there are some learning objectives that lend themselves really well to open-ended systems. There's some learning objectives that lend themselves better to a system that is a little bit tighter, I will say, for lack of a better word. As long as we're not going all the way over to the end of the spectrum where we're essentially just kind of dressing up quiz questions, then we're still, in my mind, kind of firmly in game-based learning territory. And in my mind, then we are having, you know, having the potential to reach students who maybe are uniquely reached through that pedagogy, as opposed to some of the more traditional methodologies. So I love pointing to iCivics as an example. It's an incredible organization. They've been around for a long time. They've had a huge impact. And there have been a number of studies that measure that impact that sort of demonstrate that in numbers. So you don't have to take my word for it. But can't recommend them enough.
Fantastic. And again, you know, the link to your site will be in the show notes. We'll be sure to link to iCivics as well. I have kind of a weird question, if you will, to close things up with. You know, you've referenced game design multiple times. I really appreciate you talking about, you know, the idea is not that every game has to look a certain way, that there's actually huge value in the variability. And you had me thinking about how my own relationship to games and play has evolved. Mm. You know, I kind of attribute a lot of the way that I approach my work now to having been an athlete when I was a kid. Mm. You know, a lot of those skills I feel like have kind of played right through. And then as I've gotten older, a few weekends ago, my wife and I were visiting her parents, and we brought along a board game called Codenames is, you know, it's a very simple game, but it's very fun. That was enjoyable. And, you know, my wife and I are a long way from our 20s when we used to enjoy dancing. And we were talking about like how sometimes we kind of miss that. But I am at an age where I am not going to a place anymore or staying up late enough where dancing would occur organically. And so we actually, we purchased the most recent version of Dance Dance Revolution. Oh, nice. And again, it's like, you know, you can just sort of do like 10 minutes and it's fun. Mm-hmm. Like sometimes it's a really nice way to end a stressful day. Like I feel like it's a nice little stress buster. And I'm wondering if you can leave listeners with a recommendation What is a game that either was like kind of fundamental for you in your youth in terms of, you know, maybe inspiring you to think about game design more, you know, differently, or a game that you are enjoying more recently that you would recommend to listeners, like, hey, you want to get playful? Go check this out.
Civilization and the Civilization series was really big for me when I was young. And for those who aren't familiar with the series, it's basically a historical simulation from the dawn of time to the near future, where you lead a particular civilization through the practices of diplomacy, through city building, through resource gathering, warfare, as the case may be, cultural expansion, science and technology. It's sort of the game of everything about, you know, how a civilization evolves over time. And it is not a reflection of history, because obviously you are, because it's a game, you get to make choices that were different. If I'm playing the Russians, you know, or if I'm playing an ancient civilization, I'm making different, the Greeks, let's say, I'm making different decisions than perhaps they did. Maybe I'm even starting, my civilization is starting in a different part of the world than was the case in real life or in actual historical fact. But I'm still playing by the rules of history. And in playing by the rules of history, I'm learning a ton about why things happened the way that they did. So for example, like why do civilizations that develop, why do civilizations often develop around major waterways like rivers and oceans? Why is there often war over scarce resources? Why do political alliances sometimes form and deform the way that they do? So you get these incredible moments of insight from that game by playing with the rules of history. And it's also just a ton of fun as well. So yeah, I'm a big fan of games that, I think for history as a domain in particular, which is often taught as this is what happened, which is, you know, interesting in and of its own right. I think part of one of the things that's really fantastic about history is being able to use it as a tool or a lens through which to think about contemporary, like the history that is unfolding around us every day, and to be able to think about the variables at play, that the systems at play that are modeled in that game that are very much still alive in determining how our civilization and every other civilization on this planet is evolving at this very moment. And that's incredibly, in my mind, that's just such an awesome twofer, right? To be able to learn about history at the same time, you know, you learn about facts and figures, like what was a trireme and why was a trireme, what role did triremes play in history? All the way to, like, you know, helping you understand some of the current day geopolitics and how those same situations have played out again and again across time. And you may have, in fact, yourself been involved in architecting some of those situations in this historical simulation. So great game.
Thank you for that recommendation. And you have kind of helped me solidify my own thinking in what I am looking for when I play a game. And I think it's that, you know, is this going to be a catalyst for curiosity?
Yeah.
You know, what you were just describing very much, like there's so many different wormholes to fall down. Like I would feel like it's an immediate trip to the library I need to take. Right.
100%.
And I think that's often what I'm looking for too. So, listeners, I'd encourage you have that conversation with your students. What are they looking for in a game? What would be their rubric, so to speak? And be sure, again, to check out Filament. The link will be there. And I'm thinking, too, if you teach business or entrepreneurship, this is a great episode for you to share with those students. Dan, thank you so much for sharing your experience, the work that you do, and getting us curious about the power of play. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
My pleasure. As always, folks, thank you for tuning into the Shifting Schools podcast. I do want to let you know we received feedback from a few fellow listeners who were asking if Jeff and I were going to offer anything specific on AI and feedback. So we've taken your feedback on, and coming up this April, we are offering AI-fueled feedback. This is a 90-minute webinar on April 9th. We have it priced at an early bird rate from now until March 5th. So please head on over to the show notes, learn about our early bird rate and learning with Jeff and I this April. You can also find more on AI-fueled feedback by heading over to www.shiftingschools.com. Thanks for listening. See you next week.